Good morning. This is an informal hearing on case PU-23-364, which has to do with NSP's Department of Energy nuclear settlement. I'm Randy Christman, Chair of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Sherry Haugen-Hoffert and Julie Fedorchek. I don't have any opening comments. Do either of you?
Yeah. Thank you, guys. When we got this case, it seems like there's always a little nuance with this settlement, and this year there's another nuance with it. So thank you for coming. I look forward to hearing from you, and I'm sure some of us will have some questions regarding this. So thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchek?
I don't have any. Thank you for being here.
Okay. So I mentioned the case number and what it's about. I'm not sure if I said it's just now a couple minutes after 11, February 22nd, 2024. I mentioned the commissioners. I would like everyone to go around the room and state your name into the microphone for our record, which is my insurance against misstating someone's name.
Brian Johnson, PSC staff.
Adam Renfant, staff.
Al Krug with Xcel Energy.
Pam Gorman with Xcel Energy.
Alex Nesbitt with Xcel Energy.
Victor Shook, PSC staff.
Chris Hansen, PSC staff.
Leif Clark, PSC staff.
Pam and Al, could you guys state what your roles are? Just remind
sure.
us.
Sure. I'm Vice President of State Regulatory Policy for Northern States Power Company, which is the OPCO that serves Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota.
And I'm the general manager of nuclear fleet operations, but I primarily work on policy planning and policy partnerships. Sorry. I knew there was three P's. Yeah, but my team is working on the extension of our nuclear units. That's one of the reason I'm here.
Keeping the Xcel tradition of having smart women in charge of the nukes.
Okay, well, I want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, so we deal in only undisputed information. If there's any disputed information, we will have to suspend this and issue a notice of a formal hearing. With that, I will turn it over. Alex, are you going to take the lead or whoever?
Yeah, sure. I'll take the lead, and I just want to start out by saying thank you very much for having us today. Thank you for Commission and staff for your attention to this matter, and I've got Pam and Al with me today, so we're excited to talk about this issue. A little bit of just sort of ground rules. I'll start out, I'll do just the first couple of slides, and then I'll kick it over to Pam to talk about Prairie Island, the facility itself, and then the community and some of the negotiated settlements that are the negotiated settlement involved with this matter. And as always, at any point in time, if you have any questions, would like us to go into further on any issues at all, just jump in at any point in time. We'll sort of, as always, it's circular. You ask very good questions, and usually you get to the punchline of some of the slides before we get there. So with that, just looking at the first substantive slide, which is slide number two, there's obviously history in this, just the introduction you gave. We've looked at the DOE settlements in the past. We've used this in different ways, different refunds, different mechanisms. We've used the BCR the last time we used it. This most recent refund, we received this in November of 2023. This is the 14th settlement refund that we received. This one was in the amount of $16,781,000. The North Dakota jurisdictional portion of that is $835,000. So given the timing of that, the refund that we received at the end of last year, and also the timing of the extension that we're seeking of the Prairie Island facility, seeking going to the 2050s, we've been in negotiations with Prairie Island Indian Community and their payments associated with that. And this seemed like a natural nexus given the history of our relationship with the community, the proximity of the facility to the community. Given these refunds that are coming, It just seemed like a natural nexus. There was going to need to be a filing regardless as far as the additional payments that were going to be made to the community associated with the settlement that we just reached with them with the 20-year extension. So this seemed like a natural nexus to use these DOE refund settlement amounts to offset the payment that we're making to the Perry Island Indian community. And Pam is going to go deeper into that in the facility. But I just mainly like to end off with the fact that we're very happy to have this discussion today. If you're more comfortable with putting the funds through the BCR returning to the customers, that's fine. Then we'd, as stated in the application, we would just proceed to then file a deferral and handle that matter through some other mechanism. But just given the fact that we're going to have to make a filing anyway, this seemed like a good fit for it. And given the concerns with storage and the fact that the refund settlement is stemming from the fact that we've been unable to get storage through the federal government program that's been in place there. So with that, I'll probably just kick it over to Pam, and she can get into the meat and potatoes. Thank you.
Oops, I think I went too far. There we go. Oh, sorry, I think we went all the way through. Okay. Sorry, Alex. Yeah, I think we went. I think I was going. Yeah, I think I hit it too many times and then I couldn't go back. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, commissioners, for having us today. I've met with you before, so I'll talk a little bit about our nuclear units. You're probably very familiar, but Prairie Island and our Monticello plants are really, you know, the cornerstone of our reliability on the system, providing both that affordable and reliable energy that we need. Prairie Island itself is 1,100 megawatts, and of course, online, online round the clock for those times we need it, except for when we are shut down to refueling every 2 years. Since it began operating, you see on here the units at Prairie Island have generated about 400 million megawatt hours of electricity. And as we recently did some modeling on the extension of Prairie Island, and as we were looking at extending it, we came back with results that include a savings of $464 million when modeled against PVRR. So that is something we just recently looked at, and that's between the time frame of 2024 and 2040. And again, go ahead.
The 95% capacity factor?
Yes.
Between 2020 and 2022, has it changed?
2023, we had some performance. We had both units down at the end of the year, so I would expect that capacity factor will be less, something less. We had one unit in a refueling outage, and then another unit came off. We did some cable replacements. So, again, I think the capacity factor, I haven't gotten the final number, but I would expect it will be slightly less than that 95% average. But, again, all told, as you look at, you know, it won't change the overall makeup of our nuclear units, and then going forward in 2024, of course, we expect a strong year and high capacity numbers returning. Okay, the map up there. I don't know if you have all been there or not, but this is just kind of a visual. It's the dot around, or the dotted line around the plant there is the 6-mile radius. So as you see, Red Wing, you know, straight line is about 3, 4, 5 miles away from the plant proper. Originally, the city of Red Wing, of course, was in a smaller geographic area. Once the company had announced that we were going to build a power plant, they annexed the area around Prairie Island, and that's how we became part of the city limits back before the plant started operating. So we are officially in Red Wing city limits, however, you know, a few miles out of town. Next slide.
What's the population of Red Wing?
Yeah, it's about 16,000. So earlier this month, we filed a certificate of need to extend Prairie Island. We need the certificate of need. It allows us to have the additional storage to continue to operate the plant. And then we, of course, look, you know, generally at the extension and if it makes sense for our customers. So that was filed earlier this month. We are asking for a 20-year extension of the Prairie Island plant. And as part of that, we had you know, previously to the application being submitted, we had spent time in a lengthy negotiation with the Prairie Island Indian community. And in August of 23, came to agreement and had a revised settlement agreement with them. And per that revised agreement starting this year, we have an annual payment, two new payments, the annual payment of $7.5 million for each year the plant is operating, and an annual payment per cask fee. And I'll get to it on a slide coming up, but we looked hard at that number, and it's comparable to what we are paying our host community of Red Wing, even though Prairie Island is actually adjacent to our property that you'll see on the next map. But we wanted to somehow recognize the Prairie Island Indian community and the proximity they have to our location. Certainly the plant operations, the storage has an impact on them and their residents, and we wanted to bring that payment more in line with what we were doing with our cities and counties that surround the plant.
Is that new? Did they get a payment previously, or was it
Prairie Island?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They did. It was the $2.5 million that was originally negotiated in 2003, and we had been, it actually started at $2.25 in 2003, and then in 2015, it went up to the statutory limit of $2.5. So, but it hadn't, and that was one of their points, is that it hadn't changed since 2003, and that's why one of the stipulations of our agreement with them is that we would renegotiate if we were going to extend Prairie Island or do a power upgrade. So obviously that kicked us back into discussions with them.
And the per cask, is that a new thing?
Yes.
The per cask?
Yes.
How many casks are out there?
There's 50 today. So it's another 2.5. And then the map up there, I think this is a good visual representation. Of course, on the right-hand side is the Mississippi River because we are located right along the boundaries of the Mississippi. As you see, our plant proper is in red line there. And as you look to the west of our site boundary, those are the Prairie Island Indian Community's homes. You see a ball field there. At the top of the page, you're starting to see the beginning of the Treasure Island Casino and the parking lot and some wastewater ponds they have. But as you see, they are directly adjacent to us and the closest community to a nuclear plant in the United States.
What's the population of residents living?
You know, I don't have a. I know the community is about 1,100 members. How many live on the island is probably a third of that, I would say. They have other property besides those homes right behind our property, but throughout Prairie Island. So I would say maybe a third to a half of them live on Prairie Island. It could be more, but I'm not exactly sure.
I'm not sure this matters, but popped into my head on a previous slide. When Red Wing wanted to annex this plant several miles away into town, was that something that the company was supportive of or opposed or what?
I can't speak to it. I don't know, Al, or if you have any insight to that. I don't know for sure.
I actually don't know the answer to that. That would have been in the 70s, so even I wasn't around at that time. I apologize, but we could try to find that out.
Thank you.
I think part of it was we were located in Welch Township, and we knew that the plant was going to need some services that maybe Red Wing could provide as a bigger municipality at the time. And it was actually annexed, I believe, in the early 60s. So it's been quite some time since it was that property was annexed in.
I would say municipal annexation. Munis in Minnesota have the right to annex property, and we don't. There isn't a like a legal route for us to oppose that. But I will follow up with a little more information.
Okay, so then the next slide will outline sort of those payments that we've discussed, the $10 million. Again, the part that would come to the North Dakota jurisdiction is about $517,000 of that $10 million. And again, the last bullet to your question, Commissioner Fedorchik, is the $2.5 million that was originally paid as part of that 2003 settlement agreement. And again, I've kind of covered this, but cities and counties, as you know, receive personal and real property tax from power plants to recognize sort of that extra burden that plants may place on those communities. The payments to the Prairie Island Indian community are similar to what we are already providing to the city of Red Wing. And again, I think we just viewed this negotiation as an opportunity to recognize them as a community that is in close proximity and bears some of the burdens, if you will, of this plant, and to recognize them. And that's how we came to that agreement. And I think that's all I have for any formal comments, but I think we're happy to take questions, and I really appreciate you having us here to discuss this today.
The Minnesota legislature was involved in this,
yes,
right?
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
I mean, how the agreement was arrived at and the steps you went through?
Yeah, and I'll have Al jump in if I'm not right. Maybe you want to. Do you want to do this one?
I'll take a shot at it.
Yeah.
But actually, Pam was much more involved with directly in the negotiations. But I would just say that the negotiations between us and the tribe began prior to any legislation that was developed. And really, this is quite a bit different than what we've done in the past. We saw this as an integral part of extending the life of the facility itself by 20 years. The legislation, once we came to an agreement, or essentially were ready to execute, that the tribe itself wanted more involvement from the state of Minnesota, just as they wanted a third party there. But the state actually, the legislation itself just basically memorialized what we had already accomplished with the tribe. And Pam, I don't know if there's anything else to add there.
No, I think that's correct. And then we had the signing ceremony with the governor as a, you know, three-party agreement between us, the tribe, and the state in August.
Is the $10.2 million to Red Wing, is that a real ad valorem property tax? Or is that some kind of a payment in lieu of taxes based on something completely
different? No, it's a real property tax payment that is appropriated to them. Of course, it depends on the investment we're making at our plants. But we would expect, I mean, as you know, we invest a lot of capital dollars in our plants and keep them operating. It may be 50 years old today, but we know that it's not a 50-year-old plant. So we invest significant capital dollars in those units. And so that equates to property taxes going up, I guess, or down. But typically, we see them going up in any given year.
What city is your central office located in? XL's?
Minneapolis. Our headquarters is in Minneapolis.
Yeah. And so whatever your property taxes are there, do you pay that much to Hennepin County and other neighboring counties too, just because they're also nearby?
Obviously the county and the city both are, we receive a property tax bill from both, yes. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, I didn't mean Hennepin County.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You pay to Minneapolis.
Yes.
And then do you pay the same thing to St. Paul because it's nearby?
Well, we don't. We have facilities in St. Paul, quite a few facilities in St. Paul, so we pay taxes related to that as well.
I'm going to make another example that might get a little closer. So Monticello, mm-hmm. nuclear facility is mm-hmm. near the city of Monticello.
Yes.
Is there some payment other than property taxes to either the city or the county?
Yeah. So the Monticello plant, of course, is located within Monticello city limits, and it's right outside of the city proper. So our property tax payments there are made to the city of Monticello, the county, Wright County, just like we also provide a property tax payment to Goodhue County and then the school district.
Sure. But there's no, for the Monticello plant, and I recognize it's not probably as close to
right.
that city as this is to this community.
Right.
But there's no other additional payments?
No.
Not one?
No.
Okay.
Were the tribes not supportive of the, are they not supportive of the plant?
I think the tribe is, and I don't want to speak for them, but I've worked with them for 25 years myself, so I feel I think what they have said to us is not necessarily opposed to nuclear power. However, they like us, want the federal government to take title and move that spent fuel. And that is concerning to their community members. We've actually, throughout this process, spent significant time at the community meeting with their members at their request, and there's significant concern for people that live near the plant and see the spent fuel not moving and the plant continuing to operate. And I think so part of these negotiations was trying to address and recognize, you know, them being a neighbor, our next door neighbor, and how to properly recognize the burden that they take.
Sure. So the spent, so that kind of explains the per cask payment. I'm curious why there's both components.
I think the 7.5 was just a recognition as long as the plant is operating. Again, they have some part of both, you know, the support of living next door to the plant, but then just being a host community like Red Wing. You know, clearly we get some services from Red Wing. The Prairie Island Indian community does provide some backup support, you know, when it comes to EMTs and other things that, that we request as a neighbor. But I think it was recognition of them also being a host community and located adjacent to our property. And that's where that 7.5 started from. And then the cask fee was just a recognition that as we continue to add casks, there will be a mechanism for them to be compensated for that too.
How many... what's your projection on adding casks? How many? What's your timeline?
So currently the plant is licensed through 33 and 34, and we are changing our technology there. So instead of having 64, I believe we'll have 65 by the end of 23 and 34. As we load casks, assuming we get the 20-year extension, we would then load an additional, it's about 30-ish, 34-ish, that we would load to operate from 2033-34 to 2053-54.
So then that payment would increase?
It would, yep.
So the agreement is the life of the nuclear plant, right?
As long as the fuel remains. Now, you know, of course, we're working with the tribe. We work with the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition to try and, you know, encourage the federal government to live up to the, not just promise, but the law that they would take this fuel beginning in 1998. And we do have these settlement agreements, so we get the dollars back that we spend on the cask storage, but we want them to live up to that law. We want them to move the fuel. We want them to have a place for it to go. So we are aligned with the Prairie Island Indian community and the very active members, both at the federal level and then doing everything they can on their own to influence sort of a strategy of moving that fuel.
Well, I will tell you from my olden days of being on the NCSL Energy and Environment Committee, I wouldn't hold my breath on that. So we're a lot further away from that permanent nuclear waste solution than we were in 2005.
Yeah.
That's a sad reality, but in two decades, we've moved further away, not closer.
Yes.
These payments from the taxpayers, I'm just going to throw out, and you can respond to this however you want. It seems to me either need to be used toward providing safe on-site local storage or the permanent solution, or they should go back to all your ratepayers proportionately, not a select group. And so I guess I'm not a fan of this.
Okay.
To Randy's point about them being used for storage, the amount that we're getting back, does that cover your costs for the storage?
Yes. I mean,
that's what
roughly speaking, it's so based on the settlement with DOE, every year we're submitting our costs to them. It kind of almost like a mini rate case where we're looking at our investment there, our O&M, everything, submitting a bill to them. That bill is audited, and then we arrive at a number. But it's very similar to how we would do basically a cost of service.
Okay, so then since you're paying $50,000 per cask, will that be added to the cost that you submit? Because it is a cost of storage. the $50,000 per cask fee that you're paying to Prairie Island?
Well, it's a good point, and actually we've attempted to make that point with DOE as part of the settlement. As you might recall, we had part of that initial legislation in 1994 required us to develop biomass facilities in Minnesota. Of course, those were very expensive, and we've since exited that. But at the time, our initial lawsuit with DOE requested compensation for that as well. Their pushback was that was something that was essentially we chose to do that, in a sense, if you will, meaning the lack of storage was not a direct cost. That was considered an indirect cost, meaning we, in a sense, volunteered to do that as a state. So, and similarly, for these payments to the tribe, I think the DOE does not view that necessarily as a direct cost of storage. However, from our perspective, of course, were the tribe to start opposing extension of the facility itself, mm-hmm. that would be very expensive to all of our customers and potentially delay, extension of the plant.
And when do you start the process of the permitting of the extension? And what role does the tribe have in that?
Okay, yep, and that's a good question because I was thinking that I hadn't mentioned that. So we filed the certificate of need with the state earlier this month, and that's to allow the storage and the expansion for 20 additional years. There's also a federal process, and our intention is that we will file that federal process following the state proceeding. So we filed that earlier this month. We would anticipate a decision within 2 years and then file that federal license with the NRC at the end of 2026. And again, expect about an 18 to 24 month process. That would get us out to mid 2028, which again is 5 years in advance of those licenses expiring. So plenty of time for us, but that's why we wanted to start with the state process now. And I think an important component of that was working with the tribe and making sure that what we've agreed to is that we will work constructively going forward with us, and I think that's important to resolve our neighboring issue. So
does that mean that they will participate in support of the extension?
I don't speak for them. I don't know that they will ever speak supportive, but what do you think, Al?
Well, I think, as Pam pointed out, it's a difficult spot that they believe that they're in. Being right next to the facility, their options are somewhat limited. So I think what the agreement gains is a continued constructive relationship, and I wouldn't expect them to oppose in any way the extension.
Tell us about your efforts to what the company did to try to keep the costs of this down in the negotiations.
Okay. Well, clearly it was, as I said, a lengthy negotiation. And I would just say in every negotiation, right, you start at a place, the other side starts much higher, and you come to some middle ground. And I think the way we looked at it is trying to recognize them as a host community, and that was where we ultimately ended up. But, I mean, obviously over 18 months there was a lot of back and forth. And, we knew it was important to the future of that plant to come to agreement with them, and so that's how we ended up where we did.
And it's similar in terms of the tax.
Right.
So that's a logical.
That's how we got to the place we did ultimately. But it was – there was a lot back and forth, and there was times where we would take breaks. But I was one of four from the company that participated over a lengthy period of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were representing their community too, right? And like I said, I've been at these community meetings. They're not fans of living next door to a nuclear plant.
Are there employees? Do they have employees at that plant?
They used to. When I started there, I worked for a couple of community members. But since that time, we no longer have any of them employed at the facility. Mm, we certainly like to, but
yeah.
Have chosen not to.
Okay.
You indicated, they're a host community and neighbor, and they provide some resources, too. You only mentioned one, EMT services. What mm-hmm. else do they provide?
We share the road. We share our private access road. We have a private access road if we need to shut that down. We need to use their roads at times. I think it's more of, just some neighborly things that we try to do back and forth. I'm not sure if I have any other concrete examples. They participate in emergency planning with us, of course, because they live adjacent. So they participate with emergency planning efforts. And am I forgetting anything else?
Well, only that I think you've spent a lot of time with them in the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition, which many trips to D.C. working, trying to get DOE to honor their commitments.
So I know it's probably, as Commissioner Christmas stated, it's not in the near future, but does the agreement state that if this payment ends and they do take the fuel storage and all these pods disappear, there's going to be no more payment for them then, correct?
That per cask payment goes away, yes.
Okay, but the other $7.5 million plus the $2.5 million, that's in addition, so that it's, what, $10 million then, or $10.2? So they're going to keep getting that payment even though the federal government would no longer be paying that to you guys?
As long as the plant is operating. Once the plant has ceased operation, then that would go away as well. Right, Al? I have that.
Yes, okay. That's correct.
But the money is currently coming out of that settlement with the federal government, so then that's going to be then passed on to ratepayers. Like I said, I know this is far out there, but so if that agreement ends, then all of a sudden you guys have to come up with $10.2 million plus whatever. Well, I guess the cask payment would go away then, but so then you're going to have $10.2 million coming out, and that's going to be assessed to your ratepayers then, correct?
Well, I apologize. I think what we've proposed here may be conflated two issues. First, the payments that we get from DOE every year, those are going back to all customers in all jurisdictions because everyone is paying for those facilities, all of our jurisdictions. This payment to the tribe would occur regardless of what happens to what our relationship with the DOE, meaning although it's we intermingled it here, they really are two separate issues.
So that $10.2 million is not coming out of the DOE payment?
No.
So this is in addition to that.
Isn't it 7.5 if you get rid of the casks? It's not 10.2.
The original 2.5, I'm not familiar.
So the new payment is 7.5 plus
correct.
The casks.
Correct.
Right?
Yes. Correct.
So if
yes.
the casks go away, then what's remaining is a 7.5. And that will remain regardless.
There's also a 2.5, yeah. I think.
So they would be 10. Yeah. That's correct.
Right.
What?
10
but the 2.5, I mean, for North Dakota's purposes, it's a 7.5.
Oh, I apologize. So North Dakota is not paying. Only Minnesota is paying for that initial 2.5.
Right? And we'll continue to do that.
And we could, if you'd like, we could go into how that developed. But the additional 10 right now is where we've proposed every jurisdiction to pay their proportional share.
Yeah.
So
that includes the annual payment plus the cask.
Yes.
Yes.
And you're proposing to offset that with the DOE refund.
Well, for the purposes of this filing, yes.
Yeah.
But I didn't want it to feel like it was conflated. Really, the two are separate. We
right.
could certainly recover the payments to the tribe in a different way if that was mm-hmm. if that was more acceptable. We certainly could do that as well.
And if the casks go away and you stop getting the payment from the DOE, you stop paying the tribes for the casks, but you still pay the 7.5.
Yes.
until the plant stops operating.
But I thought you said you weren't getting DOE payments for the CAS. They were indirect costs, correct?
We are getting payments from the DOE for the entire, for all of our costs related to maintaining what they call the ISFC, which I don't recall.
Independent cement fuel storage, the dry cask storage pad.
And that would include the capital costs of those casks as well as a variety of related costs.
I was curious, you alluded to the state memorializing some of the negotiated items. Did they add additional items too? Or I'm curious as to additional terms or conditions that they might have put in place beyond what you were originally contracting.
No, they did not add any other terms and conditions. They did address some recovery options, but of course those recovery requirements only apply to Minnesota.
Did I understand at the beginning, right, that the company wouldn't object, though, to North Dakota not participating in this and either returning this money directly to the ratepayers or holding it in some kind of an account for when new expenses are incurred?
That was the way that the application was drafted, was that we could use this DOE refund to offset the PI payments, or in the alternative, we could flow it all back through the BCR, and then we would seek a deferral. We'd file an application through another proceeding regarding the PI payments.
Right. Yeah, I think we certainly, and again, we understand it's a little confusing the way it's set up here because it looks like one is offsetting the other. That wasn't really our intent. We really just proposed that for convenience. Certainly what we could do is, in lieu of that, file for a deferral. We would address that in a future proceeding, probably an electric rate case whenever we would file that. One advantage of that potentially is the certificate of need proceeding would be completed, so they would be, well, more certainty around the extension of the facility, which was our primary purpose for negotiating with the tribe. So that's another option.
I think to me the original was a $2 or $2.5 million, mm-hmm. where Minnesota recognized that was something the company and the state set up and that they were paying, not the neighboring states. I think that's how the new agreement should be handled. So.
Well, we understand that. I think we just felt that this particular negotiation was much more an integral part of extending the life of the plant, which we thought all customers would benefit from. And certainly the state, in no way does the state of Minnesota, the legislation, bind any of our jurisdictions. We understand that.
Well, I think we'll probably have to have a work session on this one because I certainly understand what you're saying, Randy, and appreciate that. But with the threats that we're all seeing to dispatchable power, this one is really valuable. And I want to be on record and supporting its extension. It's hard to quantify what the risk of this might be without this kind of negotiated agreement with the tribes, but it's real. I mean, I think we all can say that's a real risk just in today's environment. So I think we need to talk about and think about it, what options we have and what the timelines are, et cetera. But I think I appreciate you guys bringing this forward.
Quick question. What is the annual operating cost of Prairie Island? Roughly. I'm just curious to get a sense of proportion of this payment to the total operating cost.
Well, go ahead, Al.
I would just say it would be very small, de minimis. It would be extremely small as a percentage.
$500 million a year, or what is? I mean,
not quite that much.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
We can get you that information. Yeah. I could throw out a number, but I want to make. I mean, I know our nuclear O&M because I'm working on that initiative right now, but I don't know. I want to get you a better number.
Thank you.
One kind of thought. I keep rolling this through my head, and I can't decide if it's a good thing to say or not. But I'm just going to spew it out there, and anyway, we'll just see where it lands. But so the 7.5 plus the original 2.5, so $10 million to the tribe is really recognition that it's dangerous living next to a nuclear plant. Because what if they're not agreeing by way of the settlement to not hold you liable if something were to happen? They would likely, in the event something happened, take that $10 million and hire the best lawyer that exists to sue you back to the Stone Age. So it's they're getting, I mean, if that happens, what they're worried about and what you're trying to pay them for, you're still going to have to.
Yeah. I mean, it's really about being a neighbor to, I mean, and I live in Red Wing, so I have I don't think of it being dangerous there. I mean, the other thing is nuclear power plants are all part of a pool. It's called the Price-Anderson Act, which is an insurance pool. So nothing goes, as a matter of fact, one of our negotiation sessions was about understanding Price-Anderson, the liability that comes with that. The tribe is not signing away anything by being part of this agreement. And again, it's an insurance policy for the whole industry. Again, I don't think that they're as opposed to the operation of the plant as it is about storage. And I think we can all agree that we're disappointed in the federal government for not living up to what they have promised us as a utility and our customers and everybody else. But it's also the law, which is why we are getting these settlement payments back. So that's where I think the biggest concern is and the way to address it. I mean, certainly individual community members have concerns living so close. I mean, I grew up in Red Wing, not really sure what was going on out there either. I mean, I don't have any of those concerns. It's not about, for me, it's not about danger, but I think it is about recognizing them as a neighbor and allowing them to have some benefits being physically adjacent to our property and, you know, hearing the plant. I mean, I get calls when they hear a relief valve go off and they don't know what that is and they're concerned. And so I think it's somehow recognizing them as it may not have the title of a host community, but nobody is closer in the United States to a nuclear power plant. And I think it is a recognition of them being so physically close to that plant.
Sure.
What's the next closest incorporated community or city after the Prairie Island Inland community and Red Wing?
Yeah, I asked the Nuclear Energy Institute. They're kind of our consortium.
Oh, I mean of this plant.
Oh, of this plant. What's the next closest community after Prairie Island?
After Red Wing. I presume Red Wing is, well, it's in
what other town is nearby?
I mean, probably Hastings. Lake City's further south, but Hastings is likely closer to the plant than Lake City.
But they would be at least 10 more miles.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe you said this and I need to clarify it. Is this negotiation for future, like when you talked about the timeline for permitting, they have a clear understanding what the process is going forward. You indicated that the question was asked is, do they oppose it? You say, I mean, you can't speak for them, but they don't come out and support. But going forward, I mean, I just wonder, or I pause, what they're going to feel like as if things go through and the permitting goes through and this, you know, you've negotiated the CAS, you know, they're going to get X amount per, but if we're going to be back, you guys are going to be back in negotiations and the costs.
No, I think that's helpful. And I will tell you the negotiations were specific to the 20-year extension. So that was how we centered our conversation is, hey, we want to file this in 2024. We want to extend Prairie Island by another 20 years, so 2053, 54. And that's what the whole negotiation was centered around, is extending the plant, allowing us to get another 20 years worth of operation. So they knew that that's what the conversation was around. And I think it's better when we can be aligned and working together on things such as spent fuel storage. That is one area. And like I said, as we can go forward on that, I think it's helpful to work constructively. That's how we ended it, was we will work constructively together going forward.
So did the agreement require them not to oppose the extension?
I don't have the exact language.
I don't have it either, but I would view it more as a neutrality agreement.
A common understanding.
Right, I wouldn't expect them to be supportive of it, but at least not be in opposition. And I would hope that would be in the agreement. I guess I'd be curious if it's something that you're able to share from the agreement. That
I think we can.
Yep. I think we can too. And that's certainly the intent.
My previous question regarding the legislation was, I guess this kind of gets back to that point a little bit, was does Minnesota legislation now explicitly state that they have to agree to, I mean, when you have a negotiation, if you have somebody who has veto power over something, then they have, you know, disproportionate power over the negotiations as opposed to them being a voice. I mean, we have the same thing. We've had the same situation in North Dakota with pipelines and things like that, where they have a voice and sometimes a very loud voice. But did the legislation then, you said, memorializes it? Does it give, does it require them to agree to like the storage in the future? I guess my question was, is what exactly did it do? Does it give them a, are they just saying they're at the table, or do they get some sort of a vote on this or situation?
Yeah, I would just say the legislation doesn't, well, first of all, it doesn't give them any veto power over extension of the facility, okay. Nor does it do the opposite, which is not allow them to. It really is silent on that.
Okay. So.
Do you know what the population was when the plant was built?
Of the tribe or Red Wing?
Of the area right adjacent to it, the where those houses.
You know, the number of homes haven't changed that much. So I think it's comparable to what it is likely today. Maybe a few. I mean, I don't know because obviously I wasn't around then. But probably more homes built. I guess I don't know. I shouldn't even speculate because I don't know.
Okay, but they were. That community was existing when the plant was
built. Oh, yeah. The community was there first.
It didn't, like, build up around it after.
No. Right. The community was there first.
The casino wasn't, though, right?
The casino was not. That was in the 80s. That's true. Yes.
You know, I would just, if I may, I do understand it's that feeling of, well, what are we really getting for this payment, meaning all of our customers? And maybe that does feel a bit more like over time we might be able to see those benefits a little more clearly, meaning if we were to separate this out as a deferral and then ultimately the certificate of need is approved, it feels like it would be a little more transparent perhaps where those what the benefit of that agreement was then, if you will.
Anything else? Are there any objections to the evidence produced here today becoming part of the official record? And by the evidence, I mean both the information in the recording as well as the slides?
Nope.
No objections. None from staff.
I think you kind of talked over each other, but both sides indicated no. So the evidence will become part of the official record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for this informal hearing? If not, we are closed. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.